had some high-severity patches in it, which were really extraordinary from a biodiversity standpoint. So I just wanted to give a little background on why we need wildfires in our ecosystems. First of all, raise your hand if you've walked through an area that has recently burned that's been a forest. Okay? Great. Raise your hand if you think the blackened forest was destroyed by the forest fire. Excellent. I don't need to say another word. You guys are great. But, you know, this is what we're dealing with. And normally in my talks, I show a slide that has half the forest is green and the other half is blackened. You could, it's like a diagonal with blackened and green. And I ask people, which is more important, the blackened or the green? And most people think green. And I've worked in rainforests for a good part of my career, so I used to think the same way. And then I got into these blackened forests and realized that there's a lot of biodiversity in these burnt forests. I started to have to recalibrate my thinking in terms of what a forest is and started to listen to nature in terms of defining a forest for me. So that recalibration process led to this book. And the book started my story, and it was, I was taking a hike with my 8-year-old daughter up to this burn area one day, and we got to the top of the mountain, the East Antelope Forest Fire, Liam's familiar with, and we had our lunch at this burnt forest, and it was high severity burn, and all the trees were dead. And I just listened to my daughter just describe, wow, look at all these songbirds and all the woodpeckers and the butterflies and the wildflowers. She was describing it to me. And I thought, wow, if an 8-year-old can get it, maybe a member of Congress can get this. I know that's a big leap, but you know, she really inspired my developing awareness for why these forests are also important. It's not just green versus blackened, it's both that are important. And in the book, Chad and I put this together. Eventually, we started it out in 2015. We had 8 months or 9 months to put this together with 27 other scientists from around the world, all sharing their experiences of these large burn areas are not ecological disasters, they're actually renewal events. And when we see these large fires, they're not just one big blackened patch. They are a mosaic of different fire effects. So you kind of think of them as, the word that we use is pyrodiversity. Not pyromaniacs, but pyrodiversity. And when we see pyrodiversity, we have variety. And variety in nature is the spice of life. So the more variety you see in the landscape, the more habitat there is for critters. So pyrodiversity begets biodiversity. And getting that message across to the public, I think, has been the hardest part of my career as a conservation scientist. The rainforest, everybody gets that. No arguments that rainforests are important. But when we look at these blackened forests, we have to recalibrate what our vision is of a forest, and we use nature to do that. Even the so-called megafires, you know, this is not megafire versus Godzilla. This, you know, these megafires are big areas, and we were on the King Fire yesterday, we saw that, big patches of high-severity fire, and over the past decade or so, scientists have been in those places cataloging their biodiversity and are seeing that the variety of species in these big blackened patches is similar to what we get in an old-growth forest in terms of just counting the number of species and also the unique species that occur in these blackened patches are as important as an old-growth forest. The public gets old-growth forest. There's no longer a social license to log old-growth forest, but they're having a hard time understanding why blackened forests are important, and they are linked. So what we do to these forests after a forest fire affects their progression through time after the renewal event of a forest fire. So fire just resets nature's clock. It resets the successional stages that occur after the forest fire. And those big blackened trees are holding the soils together. They're shading the developing conifers, their progeny, from intense sunlight, and they're restarting the whole process. So they are the most important parts of a forest, the dead, blackened trees. And that these big fire events, these big insect events, are the way that these forests replenish that supply of what we call biological legacies. And you're going to hear Chad talk about how those forests are at risk through the legislation that's going through the Senate right now and has gone through the House of Representatives, and why we're concerned about this, because what we do to these forests after a fire, which is a renewal process, affects them, and affects them probably through at least a century, because we remove those components and it destroys the renewal process that's occurring. So the fire is not the disaster. The logging that happens after the fire is. And the last point I'll make is when we were on the King Fire yesterday, we saw big patches of high-severity forest that had gone through the King Fire burn. And they are incredibly important because they're huge trees where we only got like three logs on a logging truck. That's how big these trees were. And they were going by, I estimated, every 3 or 4 minutes, a logging truck was going by this road, carrying off these biological legacies and destroying the renewal process in these forests. This is what we will see increasingly if this legislation passes, and why we're here today to discuss not only the importance of these burnt landscapes and why we need them as much as we need old growth and green forest, but how they are at risk right now. And it's probably the most difficult and challenging part of my 30 years in the career is to get people to think about forest as important, even when they have burned, and get legislators to think like my 8-year-old daughter did. Wow, these places are really cool. They've got a lot of biodiversity in them, and they need to be part of how we conserve and responsibly manage public lands. So I'm going to turn that over now to Chad, who's going to brief you on the legislative process and has also developed a lot of the materials that are out here now. If you want to come up later and get some background materials on this issue as well. So, Chad, take it away.
I have two announcements. Bill just texted me. He's stuck in a garage. Something is wrong with his car, but he's on his way, he says.
Apologize.
Oh, you're here. Okay.
Just made it.
All right. Okay. So, why don't we... Are you, Bill, are you ready to go right now? Can you go?
Or, as far as I know.
Okay. All right. So,
what would you like me to cover here, George?
Just, do you want to give us, maybe it'd be a good idea, Chad go. He'll give a summary of the legislation, you can respond to that.
Okay.
So. Hi, Bill. So I'm Chad Hansen. I'm a research ecologist with the John Muir Project, and I'll just give a little bit of background on how I got into this issue, and then I want to kind of paint a picture about what this habitat is, because not everyone's been to a patch of snag forest habitat created by high-intensity fire, especially in an area that hasn't been logged, and it's not immediately obvious, especially if what you're seeing mostly are the images of how it looks right after a fire, which does look bleak to a lot of people. So, I was monitoring a timber sale, a post-fire logging project in 2002 on the El Dorado National Forest, and I ran into a logging crew that was cutting an area of high-intensity fire that had burned, and they were focusing on that area. They had to stop what they were doing so I could pass on the road to get down to this old-growth forest stand that had burned at low and moderate intensity. And I got in a conversation with the foreman of the logging crew, and he said, you know, I understand why you guys don't want us to cut that stand down the road where it's mostly live trees. You know, I get that. But this area here we're cutting, all the trees were killed. It's been destroyed by fire. You know, what harm could it possibly do? What could possibly use this area? And I thought that was a fascinating question. And I didn't have a good answer for him at the time. But I thought it was intriguing. So that question is really what led me back to graduate school and to get my degree in ecology and to start researching this. And what I've found since then is that even at that time, there was a small but growing body of research, which has just surged into a huge body of research in the last 15 years, now with hundreds of scientific studies on this, telling us that our forests in the western United States, our conifer forests, including ponderosa pine and mixed conifer, these were mixed severity fire regimes historically. They had low and moderate intensity fire, but they also had patches of high intensity fire, some small, some large, especially in high fire weather. And that over millennia, there are many wildlife species that have evolved to depend upon the unique habitat attributes created by patches of high-intensity fire in particular. And we call this habitat complex early seral forest. That's the technical term. The more colloquial term is snag forest habitat, which I use a lot. And, you know, as Dominic mentioned, snag forest habitat is comparable to old-growth forest in terms of wildlife abundance and native biodiversity. And in fact, there are many species that are very uniquely adapted to snag forests that depend on it. And you find them, you know, very rarely outside of snag forest habitat. Many of these species have become rare and are declining because of the habitat loss due to fire suppression and post-fire logging. So basically, in terms of defining snag forest habitat, the key structural elements of it are, number one, snags, an abundance of standing dead trees, which are snags. As those break off on the tops or fall with more years post-fire, you get these wonderful down logs that's great habitat for small mammals and invertebrates and amphibians. The snags themselves, after the fire itself attracts wood-boring beetles. And these species have evolved, depending on the species, to detect fire through smoke or heat. So some of them actually have infrared receptors. They've evolved in their bodies, and they detect these fires from dozens of miles away. And they make a beeline for the fire area, oftentimes arriving before the smoke is fully cleared. They lay their eggs on the bark of the charred bark of a fire-killed tree. The larvae develop. They bore under, and that's what they feed on, the freshly killed trees. And the woodpeckers depend on and feed on the wood-boring beetle larvae, and these are native species. So these woodpeckers depend on that food source, and the beetles depend upon fire or periodic drought conditions to create those patches of dead trees. So one of the key ones is the black-backed woodpecker. The black-backed woodpecker is the absolute champ of foraging on the wood-boring beetle larvae and excavating nest cavities in these relatively hard new snags. They're monogamous species. The male will create two or three, sometimes up to four nest cavities in a single season. And even when they stay in the same territory, one black-backed woodpecker eats 13,500 wood-boring beetle larvae every single year. So a single pair, a single family, needs generally at least 200 or 300 acres of mature, dense forest that burns at high intensity in order to have enough food to survive. And they're incredibly sensitive to post-fire logging. So when they create these nest cavities, the ones that they don't use, because the female picks the one that she likes the best every spring of the ones the male creates, and all the other nest cavities are available for all the secondary cavity nesters in the forest to use, bluebirds and nuthatches, even flying squirrels. And so basically, we call them a keystone species ecologically because their importance in the ecosystem is disproportionately high. And then you've got these native flowering shrubs that germinate following intense fire. That attracts flying insects, butterflies, wasps, bees. That provides food for all these fly-catching birds. And the shrubs themselves and the down logs provide great habitat for small mammals. And so you have this very, very rich system that's providing food for not just birds and small mammals, but also a lot of these shrubs are berry-producing plants. They produce berries that the bears get fat on before the winter. It's forage for the deer. And spotted owls preferentially hunt and select these areas for foraging because that's where their small mammal prey base is the best, even as they're nesting and roosting more in the low and moderate intensity areas. We call this the bed and breakfast effect. And it's something that we see a lot, that that juxtaposition of this dense old forest and this dense old forest that burns at high intensity, creating great snag forest habitat. It's that juxtaposition of these extremes that is so important for biodiversity. So the legislation takes all these lessons that we've learned.
Could you say the name of it?
Yes, there's two different bills. One is it's HR House Resolution 2647, and the Senate just passed a a version of it through the Agriculture Committee, and that's S3085. And there's another one that's similar that has not been introduced yet but is being discussed in the Senate called the Wildfire Budgeting Response and Forest Management Act of 2016. And that is being promoted by Senators Crapo and Murkowski and Wyden primarily. Crapo from Republican from Idaho, Murkowski Republican from Alaska, Wyden Democrat from Oregon. All some of the top recipients of timber industry campaign contributions in the Congress. And essentially what these bills do, all of them in various forms, is ignore all the lessons that we've learned through the scientific research in the past 15 years about the incredibly high importance of this habitat and the naturalness of these patches of high-intensity fire, small and large. And instead, the approach is to severely weaken the National Environmental Policy Act so that logging projects up to 3,000 acres, or in some cases larger, would be exempt from environmental analysis and normal disclosures of adverse impacts, exempt from normal public participation requirements. And as long as the Forest Service basically presents these logging projects as forest health projects, restoration projects, fuel reduction projects, wildlife habitat improvement, there's a list of terms which, you know, we see as euphemisms, that can be used. And if they present the projects in that way, then they get these exemptions from environmental analysis. This includes any type of logging. Anything goes. Clear cutting of old growth forest, clear cutting of snag forest habitat, high grade logging of old growth trees. Anything is possible under this so long as they use these buzzwords. And this is all being done based upon this sort of politics of fear about fire. Terms like catastrophic wildfire and megafires are being used to sort of demonize fire, and particularly high-intensity fire, and patches of snag forest habitat, whether it's created by drought and these native bark beetles or by fire, to basically roll back the clock and go back to sort of a mid-20th century style of logging on national forests and ramp up logging tremendously. The other thing I'll mention is that in all cases, these bills are these logging provisions are bootstrapped to provisions that would address this fire borrowing issue that is a legitimate budgetary concern. And basically what that means is during fire season, if the money appropriated for the fire suppression program runs out, they borrow money from other funds that are not related to fire suppression. And it's created a lot of budgetary hassles. And people have legitimate concerns about that. So instead of just addressing that issue directly and dealing with it, they understand that the agencies want this fire borrowing issue fixed, and they're bootstrapping these logging provisions to that in order to get what they want. And so one of the things that is I think really indicative of the wrongheadedness of these legislative proposals and how regressive they are in terms of the science is that one of the provisions that would create this exemption from environmental analysis is for any project that would clear-cut an area to ostensibly create early successional forest for wildlife. And, you know, this bothers Dominic and I in particular because, you know, we understand as ecologists the profound difference between a clear-cut, which creates, you know, in forestry terms, an early successional area versus early successional habitat created by fire. So I'm going to pass around. We're going to take a low-tech approach this morning. I'm going to pass around. Thank you, George. That's a paired photos. Snag forest habitat. This is at 12 years post-fire in the Star Fire versus post-fire clear cut, and the same thing here. And you guys can just maybe just one on each side, one pair on each side. And I'll just give you a sense of, you know, just visually of what we're talking about. The legislation equates these two things as the same. A clear cut is the same as snag forest habitat. Barren ground and a stump field is the same as this rich, biodiverse, wildlife abundant ecosystem. Yeah?
This is, you say, 12 years post-fire?
Yes.
And this is how long post-clear-cut?
Yeah, that's recent post-clear-cut. Yeah.
So we're kind of apples and oranges here, aren't we? Because this is 12, what will this look like in 12 years? This will look better than this in 12 years, right?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it would look better. It's going to look like a tree plantation, right?
Well, so fair enough.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not going to look like this in 12 years.
Yeah, what I'm...
I just think it's important we understand that these, we're
we're looking at different time frames here, not just two different styles.
Sure, we can talk about what a clear cut and a tree plantation looks like at 12 years too. The point is this: that is the picture of the clear cut there. That is what they're doing, whether it's post fire habitat or green forest. That is what they're doing to ostensibly create early successional habitat. So I'm going to give you. I mean, you raised a good question, so I'm going to pass this around, too, and this one. These are pictures of snag forest habitat immediately right after the fire, about the same amount of time after that clear cut was done. This is post-fire without the clear cutting, about the same amount of time post-fire. So I'll pass these around, too, because it's an important question you raised. And I think you can all look at
yourself.
That's all
I raised? And see the contrast. So, I mean,
this is the rim fire, by the way.
It's
the rim fire.
And what are we looking at?
So you're looking at... Lupins?
Right. I mean, how long post-fire?
This was the first year or the second year post-fire.
Okay. And what is that?
And that's the rim fire also, and I took that, this was 3 years post-fire, but also very recent post-fire.
Okay. So these are pretty much the same thing. Yeah. You have 2-3 seasons post-fire, severe burn.
Right. Whereas the clear cuts I showed you, that's 3 years post-fire clear cut.
Gotcha.
Okay, are you done?
Yeah.
Okay. And Bill, you want to go? And I mentioned you before, but why don't you introduce yourself too? Just tell about your background before you start.
My name is Bill Snyder. I'm a retired forester. I had a career that spanned about 40 years, primarily in the Sierra Nevada. And as I look at some of these issues, appreciate Chad's views and other thoughts on this, having gone through a few of these large fire incidents myself, it is kind of an interesting and complex problem we face in California. I think one of the things that everybody generally agrees on is that we've had a relatively long history of fire suppression, and that history of fire suppression has impacted and affected the natural ecosystems in a number of ways. And really, before you can talk about an ecosystem effect, you really need to talk about what type of ecosystem you're dealing with. Because certainly the mixed conifer pine forests of the mid-elevation Sierras are a unique system compared to chaparral or desert. And in some cases, the threats to a desert might be from invasive species such as grasses that have come in that basically predispose those ecosystems to higher levels of fire and are stressors within that system that, you know, the native vegetation has not developed under naturally. Chaparral's a little different issue. I think most people think that chaparral is a fire-driven ecosystem, but really it's not. It is a system that has relatively long fire return intervals. The thing that's affecting those is the juxtaposition of humans and human beings within those chaparral forest types. And you think about the millions of acres that are in chaparral and the millions of people that occupy those acres, and the human-caused fires really create threats to those types of ecosystems. But to get to some of the issues relative to where we are, the incidence of fire is increasing. The size of the fires are increasing. Severity is increasing. As Chad points out, there's a lot of research. What that has done from a budgeting perspective, particularly on federal lands, is led to the situation where the federal agencies are having to essentially borrow, or some people might say rob, other program areas within the Forest Service in order to conduct firefighting operations. As we look at this and as it's progressed, I think some of the statistics I looked at, a couple, up to 42% of the total agency budget was spent in firefighting. And as we look at how that affects the other agency programs, in essence, it takes money from state and private forestry. It takes money from vegetation management. It takes money from maintenance of roads. It takes money from maintenance of bridges. It defers maintenance. And all of these things are causing budgetary stresses. So at the core, I think, the legislation that was originally proposed is looking at trying to figure out how to pay for the firefighting component of the federal firefighting effort without having to borrow internally from the budgets of other program areas within the agency. Now, as Chad points out, there is no good concept that doesn't have things that get tagged on to it. And in this case, some of the federal legislation then looks at exemptions from or streamlining NEPA processes and EA processes and other sorts of things. And I think all of those things, the more stuff you add to something, the more controversial things become. And, you know, as I look at California, which is the state I'm most familiar with, I'm really not familiar about the total western United States. But California in particular, I think, with the population we have, I think fire suppression, what we do with ecosystems that have been so significantly altered over time, and how we approach that really needs a holistic approach. And it's good to see we're focused here on, you know, a funding solution to deal with how to put out fires. But really, I think there are some bigger issues that need to be brought to bear in terms of what to do with the current landscape that we are currently faced with, because there are a lot of challenges out there. I think one of the things that distresses me is I understand the need to protect these large trees on landscapes. But as I see some of the stressors that are currently now impacting the Sierras in particular, with drought and insect-driven mortality, the fact that we've allowed stand densities to increase to levels now which make them susceptible to bark beetle infestations has led, I think, to higher levels of mortality than most people would consider to be acceptable. And what that means is that a lot of these trees, particularly ponderosa pine, at the lower elevation between the oak woodlands and the transition to the mixed conifer, are now under significant pressure, and there's been a lot of large trees lost due to insect impacts. Could we have prevented that? Probably not entirely, but I think this whole issue of management and management of these landscapes to figure out how we can best make them more resilient is important, and I think they are more than buzzwords, really. I think there are things that need to be brought to bear in terms of science and ecosystem management that need to be discussed. And certainly this bill gets to the suppression piece, but more important to me is, well, what do we do to move forward in this environment that we've created over the last 100 years of suppression of fire? And even where timber harvesting has occurred, I mean, one of the things that struck me years ago was a photo series that George Gruhle had done, which looked at Yosemite Valley and looked at vegetation change over time. And one of the more striking things that hit you about some of these photo series is just how much the density of the vegetation on the landscape has increased. And I think that's true almost everywhere you go in the Sierras. And certainly we're not going to roll things back to the 1900s. But I think we do need to take a look at where we are now and what role fire will play in creating ecosystems that are healthier than they presently are. So I guess that's for just an opening shot. Okay. That is...
I want to leave some time for questions and answers, but we still have time. So either one of you want to say anything further, and then Bill, if you want to respond to whatever they say, go ahead.
So I would like to – I wonder if we could focus on how we move forward, the question that Bill raised. And one of my thoughts on moving forward on this is that there have been a series of interesting papers that have come out in the literature recently about how do we get to coexistence with fire. And it was really curious to me yesterday in the King Fire field trip that the Forest Service was talking about how they were throwing everything they could at this fire. They were putting in as much resources as they could to suppress the fire, and it wasn't working. So I asked her, well, if you couldn't stop the fire, why were you trying to stop the fire? And it was like a deer in the headlights. She didn't know how to answer the question. And to her credit, it's because the agency's so locked into suppression at any cost that you might as well just throw money out the plane window instead of air tankers trying to suppress these big fire events because you can't stop them. So the resources really need to focus in on containment around structures and working with people to reduce their fire risk. What we do in the backcountry makes no difference when we have extreme fire weather blowing through canyons, putting firefighters at risk. We really need to let more of these fires go. And there's a cost containment issue in terms of suppression dollars is spiraling out of control. It's a blank check coming from Congress. They're just pulling it from one budget instead of another. So we really need to look at cost containment, prioritization, not putting firefighters at risk, working with homeowners. And there are other reasons why we want to restore our landscape, but I don't think what we're doing to those landscapes in terms of trying to reduce their susceptibility to fire is having an effect that we think it's having. In fact, it might be having the opposite effect. One other thing I'll mention real briefly is we have a new study that's coming out. There's a synthesis here, and it's coming out in the journal Ecosphere. It's in press now. I think I could say something about it. Chad and I are co-authors along with Curtis Bradley from the Center for Biological Diversity. That study looked at 1,500 forest fires from 1984 to 2014 across the western United States in all forest types. And we accounted for the effects of climate, elevation, forest types. What we tested was the hypothesis that's now happening in this legislation, that the more management we do with these forests, the lower the fire severity. That was our hypothesis that we tested. When we looked at the 1,500 fires representing over 20 million acres of burned forest, what we found was the opposite, that forest fires burning in national parks and wilderness areas were burning more in this mixed severity component, like nature designed them to. Forest fires burning in heavily managed forest systems were burning in higher levels of high severity. And this isn't high-quality, high-severity habitat. This is forest fires burning through plantations, through slash piles, where they blow up. So we were seeing the opposite effect of what this legislation is going to give us more of. More intense management on these landscapes, more severe fire in low-quality wildlife habitat. That's what we were seeing. So that's going to come out sometime next month.
Bill, do you want to respond in a way?
Well, certainly. I think as we look at what drives fire and fire behavior, I think surface and ladder fuels are generally recognized as the components which carry fire. And
Bill, I don't think everybody will know what a surface or ladder.
Yeah. Okay. So what we're talking about surface fuels, that basically is the duff and litter, forbs and other sorts of plants that are on the surface. Now, the ladder fuels typically are those fuels within the forest that are, you could think of, are saplings, seedlings, those sorts of things, which basically can carry flames up into the crowns of standing trees. You know, I think it'd be interesting to look at the research that Chad and has done here and compare that to other research, but I think we really need to focus on what it is we can do to get prescribed fire and to get fire back into these ecosystems in a way that makes sense. And, you know, I look at things and events like the Rim Fire and recognize the fire behavior that was apparent in there. It is an interesting piece. And the thing that disturbs me a little bit about this, I think, as we look at climate and as we look at longer periods of time where fires can burn with intensities that basically are stand replacing events, it is a little frightening to me to think about where we go. Yeah, I look at the Cedar Fire in 2003 that burned a large part of Cuyamaca, which was a very isolated conifer-dominated ecosystem on top of a peak that was essentially consumed. There were no seed trees left there. And so it has basically come back, and if you look at the pictures of that fire, they would look very similar to this. But from an ecological perspective, what will be a forest of the future there, and would there be a forest of the future there, and do we care? And if we care, could we have done something that might have prevented a different, that would have led to a different outcome? If you think about conifers, particularly pines and Doug fir, you know, their survival strategy primarily in these fire events is to survive and take advantage of the seedbed that's been created. They compete with species that are more low-growing, that store seed in the soil, that respond to those events. Or they sprout, or they have some other survival strategies. But in instances where you have large areas covered by high-severity fires, in order for conifers to return to that area, it will take quite a while. It would have to start to come from the edges. I would like to see strategies which certainly result in mixed severity fires. We do need openings, but we also need survival of individual trees to repopulate those areas. Otherwise, I can see climate and fire and other stressors driving some of these ecosystems to different species and type changes and other things that are going to occur. And I think those folks that look at climate modeling and look at how that climate overlays plants and plant distribution in the state recognize that we're going to see changes in California. Certainly, the vectors that cause that change are going to be related largely to fire, given our climate. But there are other things related to drought, extension of growing season, changes in precipitation patterns that are going to affect vegetation. And I think finding a way forward through this that makes sense for the landscapes that we look at is going to be important. And certainly look forward to reading the research and papers here. But there is a lot of research that does indicate that through treatment of stands, through manipulation of the surface and ladder fuels, you can influence fire, and you can influence fire behavior, and you can influence tree survivability when fires do run through a stand. So, like everything else in life, there's shades of gray, and I think what we need to do is figure out a pathway through those shades of gray to get us to an outcome which really does benefit those ecosystems which essentially we have allowed to get a little bit out of whack, if you will, over the years through fire suppression and other management activities.
I just want to make an observation here that I've been dealing with fire stuff for about four decades, and there's been a real shift, and this is a good example, even the people at this table, plus what I heard yesterday, in that there's a general acceptance now that there's a role for wildfire to play in the ecosystems. The debate now is more about what kind of role and where and so forth, but there's a general acknowledgement. I don't think the public has this down yet, but among people that deal with forests, scientists and foresters and so forth, there's at least a general consensus some fire in some places is a good thing, and we need to figure out how to accommodate wildfire as a natural ecological process. So keep that in mind. That's an important, you know, change in attitude that's occurred over the years. So either Chad, go ahead.
So one of the things I love about this field of forest and fire ecology is that so many of the things that are emerging in the published studies, when we look at these questions, are counterintuitive, or at least seemingly so. I'm just going to go through a few of those because I think these are fascinating, especially in light of how much they vary from widespread popular perceptions about these issues. Okay, so one thing that you hear a lot is that because of fire suppression, the most fire-suppressed forests, particularly in ponderosa pine and mixed conifer forest types, the ones that have, as people sometimes put it, have missed the most fire return intervals, that because of they become so dense and because of fuel accumulation, they'll burn mostly at high severity. They'll burn much more severely than forests that have burned more recently and generally are less dense. We're not finding that at all. In fact, we're finding that there's very little difference, if any. Usually there's no difference. And in fact, oftentimes those forests burn less intensely. So that's true even with the ones that have not burned in 80 or 100 years or more, where historically on average they burned every 25 or so. And so basically, we think one of the reasons for that is that as these stands get more mature and canopy cover increases, there's more cooling shade on the understory. The surface fuels stay more moist later into the fire season. As the understory gets less sunlight, as that stand gets denser and more mature, a lot of the understory vegetation, a lot of those kind of shrubs and small trees, they start to die back. This stand sort of self-thins in a way. And there's a number of factors that are countervailing. And so, again, you know, it seems like it should be true, but it's not. And there have been about 7 studies published on that now, and they are consistently finding those areas burn mostly at low and moderate severity. And all but one of them has found that fire severity is not higher in the most long unburned forest, the most fire-suppressed forest. The only one that found the opposite was a study done by some Forest Service researchers, and they found a slight increase in fire severity based upon modeling, but it was modeling that wasn't based on actually any empirical data. That was just sort of, you know, fed into the model based upon some assumptions that they thought were reasonable. So I think that that's important to keep in mind, too. The other studies are all empirical studies based on actual fires and real-world circumstances. So that's one. The other one, and this one I think is even more interesting in a way, but it dovetails with the first. There was a study done by Doerr and Santin, D-O-E-R-R, just earlier this year, and they pulled together all the literature on this issue, looking at do we have an unnatural excess of fire, or in particular high-severity fire, in these western conifer forests, especially these ponderosa pine and mixed conifer forests that get a lot of the attention. Do we have that unnatural excess, and is fire getting more severe, which is what you hear constantly? They pulled together all of the studies that have been published on this over the past decade, particularly those that have been published in the last 3 or 4 years, the most recent data. Dominic and I have worked on a couple of those studies together and published them, but lots of groups of authors, different people from different institutions, have looked at this. And here's their conclusion, summarizing the literature. For the western USA, they indicate, they're talking about the literature, indicate little change overall in terms of high severity trend. In other words, they're saying that it has not gotten more severe. Little change overall, and also that area burned at high severity has overall declined compared to pre-European settlement. In other words, they're saying we have less of this snag forest habitat in our forests, including ponderosa pine and mixed conifer forests, now than we did historically because of fire suppression. Now, when you already have less of that habitat being created by fire in the first place, and you compound that deficit with a huge proportion of it being removed by post-fire logging and subsequent activities like herbicide spraying and tree plantation establishment, then that explains why a lot of these bird species and a lot of other species that are associated with snag forest habitat, why they become so rare and are declining. And I looked at this a couple of years ago in the Sierra Nevada, and it turns out the forest bird species that depend on snag forest habitat, either because of the snag or the shrub component, they're declining at a much higher proportion of them are declining than those that are dependent on or mostly associated with low severity or unburned mature forest. And so actually this is a major conservation concern. So in terms of the extent, you know, Dominic and I highlight the ecological importance of snag forest habitat. You know, that doesn't mean you necessarily can't have too much of a good thing. Just because it's good habitat doesn't mean it can't be too abundant on the landscape. And so, you know, we stress this point all the time. We don't want too much fire, but we also don't want too little. Right now, we're in a deficit situation. That's the conservation concern. But that doesn't mean we couldn't theoretically have too much. But we need to pay attention to that. But right now, the conservation concern is the lack of abundance, not the overabundance. And, you know, in this Sierra Nevada, to put it in perspective, I looked at the Forest Service's data on this recent pulse of tree mortality from drought and these native bark beetles, and I combined that with a high-severity fire in recent decades. And the combination basically means that less than 6% of the forests in the Sierra Nevada are in this condition of snag forest habitat that's been created. Now, that's how much has been created, either by drought and native beetles or fire, and a large portion of that has been post-fire log. So the actual amount on the landscape is even less than that. But just to put in perspective, because it's very easy to go to a large high-severity fire patch, like the biggest one in the King Fire that we saw yesterday, or into a couple of the largest patches of this recent mortality, these recent snag recruitment events in the southern Sierra Nevada, where the biggest patches are from drought and native bark beetles. It's easy to go into those areas and then sort of think, wow, you know, the whole mountain range looks like this. But in reality, these things are very punctuated in the landscape. And these larger patches of that kind of habitat are actually extremely important from a landscape heterogeneity standpoint. You know, we see a large tract of old-growth forest, and we think this is wonderful ecologically. If we see a 5,000 or a 10,000 or a 15,000-acre area of old-growth, we think that we cherish it. It's an ecological treasure. It's a rarity because we understand it's biodiverse. We understand it's ecologically important. We understand it's threatened. And it's rare. Scientifically, everything about that is equally or more true about snag forest habitat. But as a society, we have yet to understand, from a cultural standpoint, that we need to view it the same way. If we see that big patch of high-severity fire, we need to understand that's an ecological treasure. That is a biological hotspot. And because it's rare on the landscape now compared to what it used to be, and because it's so threatened, we need to prioritize those areas, just like we do for old-growth forests, for protection.
Bill, do you want to respond to anything there? And then we're going to go to questions from the audience.
I'm not a scientist, and I haven't done a lot of research, but you know, just my personal observations and the research I've read is leads me to conclude that you know there are a lot of things out there that are creating snags, and you know I get a little frustrated when I hear I look at what's occurring in the Southern Sierras, and when we're talking Southern Sierras, we're looking at Tuolumne County south. And the inventories of dead trees, and these are primarily pine that are showing up, indicate there were 66 million trees dead. And if you look at pictures of those landscapes, I don't personally believe there are snag deficits there or that there will be snag deficits there. The thing that I do grow concerned about is thinking about what's next for those ecosystems. Certainly, there is a lot of dead material there standing. A lot of it will fall on the ground. The thing about what happens now is there are a lot of trees, particularly conifers, that have escaped that in the smaller sizes because they weren't of a size that the bark beetles could kill. But the next event, the next stressor, say a fire comes through, what I see happening in a lot of these landscapes is loss of the pine component, which I think basically reduces heterogeneity by removing the conifer component or allowing things to occur which simplify that, where you have a more oak-dominated ecosystem. So, and certainly, that's just my own observations as I look at some of these hillsides and will wonder what is next for these things and lay that against a climate change piece. Well, is this something that just is going to happen that we really can't or should do anything about? Or should we look to strategies which try and maintain heterogeneity in these forested stands when we can maintain it? And when I talk about fire severity, I'm always surprised, I look at a fire severity map that the Forest Service produces post-fire. And as you drive through the fire, it might be 15, 16,000 acres in size or more. If we look at the rim fire, there are not many living conifers there. And looking at how conifers exist in that, I don't see any potential for there to be any conifers in those landscapes in the near term. And I don't personally find that acceptable. And I do think that some restoration and some intervention strategically done to maintain conifers in some of these ecosystems where they can persist is important. And that could be where Chad and I might disagree. I do think there are opportunities to do some restoration work on these large fires to place conifers back in there. We know how to do it. We know how to get the trees to survive. And to just allow thousands and hundreds of thousands of acres to convert to non-forested conditions, to me, that doesn't make sense. But that's, we're far away from the legislation that we started to talk about. And those are just based on my personal observations and personal interactions with large fires over time, and starting with what I thought at the time was a large fire in Tuolumne County called the Woods Ridge Fire, 15,000 acres. And then Stanislaus Complex in 1987, 150,000 acres. And then the Rim Fire, which burned over large parts of the Stanislaus Complex. But there are some things out there that are occurring that I think are going to change and drive type change in California landscapes. Some of them are, given the climate situation, probably not much we can do. But I think there are some of them in certain circumstances where some management, some restoration post-fire is well worth thinking about.
Okay,
I wanted to.
Okay, real quick, because we're going to go to questions.
So, I mean, I think I understand that concern. I really do. When you get these large, high-intensity fire patches, the assumption is that those areas will not naturally regenerate because you don't have a live tree seed source close by, especially the interior areas. It's a long ways, hundreds of meters, if not longer, from the nearest live tree edge. And so the assumption for such a long time was that you won't get any conifer regeneration there, and therefore that drove the proposals to clear-cut these areas and artificially plant them. It turns out that once we actually encourage the Forest Service in various ways to stop logging a lot of these areas and we could actually see what happens there, we're finding that even in these largest high-intensity fire patches, we're seeing abundant and highly heterogeneous regeneration of conifers, even in the far interior of these areas. So it's not just about the proximity to live trees. It's also surviving seeds in the cones. Seeds are being dispersed by birds and small mammals. I'm doing research in the Rim Fire on this right now, and I'm finding this wonderful amount of regeneration. In fact, one of the pictures I passed around is taken in the middle of one of the largest high-intensity fire patches, and it just shows you what is going on in there. Some areas have 20 or 30 conifer seedlings per acre. Some have 5,000. Many have 2, 3, 4, 500. So it's heterogeneous. There's oaks. The oaks are already 10 to 20 feet tall in many cases in the Rim Fire. But when those areas are post-fire logged, even the Forest Service acknowledges this, about 3/4 or more of that natural conifer regeneration is killed. And you can see that from some of the pictures I passed around. It's literally killed because this is almost all ground-based logging. And so we have very real threats from climate change, and we may see some shifts in forest in terms of what forest type can be supported on a given area as temperature increases. But those threats are not going to be ameliorated or lessened by logging. They're going to be exacerbated by it. And fire is not, as we're seeing it, based on the evidence, is not a threat to resilience. It is part of resilience. It's actually helping these forests regenerate and maintain their capacity to exist on the landscape. So I just want to throw that out there because I'm looking at this very question, and Cuyamaca State Park in the Cedar Fire is another example. We're seeing in the most recent studies a nice mix of conifer regeneration coming in as well, and it's going to build and build over time. It continues, And, you know, it's going to be complex early cereal forest for a few decades or a couple of decades, and then it's going to succeed to conifer forest again.
Okay. Thank you, all three of you. Now I'm going to open it up to Q&A. Okay. We got all sorts of hands up. I'll repeat the question, and when I repeat it, I might summarize whatever you're asking and tell me if I've said it clearly. Okay? In the back there.
Hi. Size of fires due to climate change. And you know, the stat that 14 of California's largest 20 wildfires have all burned in the last 10 years, going back to the Mount Gia fire in 1932 or whatever. Yet I then hear people rebutting that saying, oh, no, the increase in intensity that you're seeing and the increase in the size of the fires is all due to fire suppression. But then I hear you guys cite studies that you're not seeing that. And so I got the triangle now. Can you guys sort of sort through that size, intensity, and frequency of the fires relating to fire suppression and climate change?
Has everybody heard his question pretty well? Because I don't think I want to repeat it. Okay. Anybody want to take a shot?
Chad will, but if you could identify who you are while you're asking the questions, I think it would help us too. So could you identify?
Oh, I'm sorry, I did it, but I'll say it again. You're cutting the pond.
Thank you.
Yeah, so this is you identified one of the core questions, and this is something we address in our book, The Ecological Importance of Mixed Severity Fires, Nature's Phoenix. We published this last year through Elsevier, and we talk about this in the book as the shifting baselines problem. And it's not that what you're hearing is untrue. It's that it is a partial truth that gives a misleading impression, the way it's being discussed, because the baselines that are being used to frame these things, the increase in fire, is basically the mid or late 20th century until present. So if you look at 1960 to present, then you would form the conclusion, as the Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack did, that last year at 10.1 million acres, that was the record fire year, an unprecedented fire year, because he's using that baseline of 1960 to present. Well, we know that from multiple data sets that in the early 20th century and in the 1900s, we had 30 or 40 million acres burning oftentimes each year in the United States of wildland fire. And this was normal. There were whole public campaigns at the time in the Forest Service's early days of their fire suppression program saying, don't let another 30 million acres burn this year. But if you look at 1960 to present, you would conclude we have an unnatural excess of fire. If you look at natural levels before fire suppression, you understand we have a deficit. And so I just want to put that out there because it's really important to understand this context. The other thing that is key here is in this paper, this Dorr and Santin paper I mentioned, it's one of the key problems they identify is that consistently, many, many times in scientific studies, papers that don't address empirically the question of whether fire severity is increasing will just say in the discussion section, well, we know fire severity is increasing, and it's a major concern, and we'll put that out there. And those papers get cited for that proposition, even though it's not empirically addressed in those papers. And what they address in this paper is the disconnect between the empirical literature that actually directly investigate whether fire severity is increasing, which overwhelmingly conclude in western conifer forests of the U.S. it's not increasing, and the perception out there, including among many scientists who make this representation in the discussion sections of their paper. And so they sort of puzzle about it, that this is a serious problem, this, you know, sort of disconnect, cognitive disconnect.
I could add two quick points to that. One quick point is that a lot of people think, well, that was yesterday. What are you doing for me today, right? And so the difference is we've got somewhere like 46 million people now living in the wildland-urban interface, mostly in the western United States. So we've got that problem, which comes back to the earlier discussion about focusing the resources to protect homes and firefighters. The second thing is the climate signal, the elephant in the room. And even if we project forward into the next century and in places in the West where we're going to see increasing not only temperatures but evapotranspiration losses, and that's going to stress these forests, what that means is that these fires are increasingly going to be driven by top-down processes. Extreme fire weather becomes the new norm. So you can't look at averages anymore. You've got to look at extremes. And when you're in that kind of extreme scenario, it's not fuels that are governing these fires. It's extreme fire weather. You can't put them out. You can't thin them out. You can't salvage them out. They're going to burn through anything except maybe a Walmart parking lot. And so we've got to start thinking about solving this problem is going to take a bigger solution than treating fuels. You've got to address the climate change issue, fossil fuels. It's a bigger problem than just thinning a forest or salvage logging.
I guess the good thing is we got more Walmarts going in. But Bill, would you like to say anything there?
You know, I just wanted to point out that there is a lot of research by other researchers as well who are concerned about, you know, the trend in increasing fire size and severity. And, you know, obviously fire severity can be directly related to the conditions under which the fires burn. A fire in the chaparral in May is much different than a fire that starts in the chaparral in October under a Santa Ana wind condition. Climate, I think, is going to be a significant driver, because what it is going to do is increase the number of days when conditions are such that fire severity and the way these fires are burning, you can't control them. They won't respond to control issues. And I think to ignore the fact that you have fuel out there, you know, to assume that less fuel on the landscape is no different than heavy fuels on the landscape in terms of burn intensity, I think is not a correct assumption. And we can do things to reduce the fuels, but it will take management to do that. And the difficulty is, when you think about the scope and scale of what needs to be done, it is staggering. Forest Service alone manages 20 million acres here in California, and you know, some of their researchers and modelers have looking at, in order to be effective, if they strategically place field treatments, they'd have to treat 10 to 20% of that landscape. And that in itself is a big number. You're talking 2 million to 4 million acres. And whether or not there's going to be a social license to do that is a key question. And whether or not society, in terms of air quality and other sorts of things, is going to be willing to put up with smoke is another question. Because my experience with people's willingness to put up with smoke is that it's a really low bar. And if we're going to talk about reintroducing fire into these ecosystems, clearly there are times of the year when we can do that. However, those times of the year are times when we don't get complete combustion. We've got more moisture out there. We get more smoke out of those things. And it's going to be an interesting struggle, I think, as we move through this whole piece. But fires will get bigger. They will burn more severely. And the number of days here in California where those conditions under which those fires will occur is going to increase due to climate change. There's no way to get around it. I wish I had a solution that would make everybody happy, you know, in terms of how to deal with this. But it's a complex piece, and it's one that we've been struggling with for a long time. But that's probably all I have to say. Other than anecdotally, you know, when I first graduated from college, which was some years ago, the early 70s, you know, I dealt with a fire, replanted it. We didn't replant everything. And I went back to that area 40 years later, And those areas that we didn't plant were still in brush. And, you know, I think there's things that can be done to help restore these fire burned over areas. And I'm not really convinced walking away in the entirety is all that appropriate response.
Okay, another question. Jane. Did everybody hear that question pretty well? Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think one of the key incentives that's blocking reintroduction of fire and restoration of fire in the landscape is the way the logging program, the commercial logging program, is set up on national forests and other federal public lands. The way the system is set up is that when the Forest Service prepares a logging project, a timber sale, and they sell public timber to private logging companies, and they keep most of the receipts, the revenue, from that logging program to fund their budget and do the next logging project. With post-fire logging, they keep 100% of the revenue from that. So it's a powerful, perverse incentive to call logging fuel reduction and call it restoration and resilience, whether it's post-fire clear cutting or whether it's logging a mature forest. That becomes the default, as opposed to fire, either managed wildland fire or prescribed fire. And the second one, I think, is that there's this history in the Forest Service of acceptance only of homogeneous low severity fire. That's a good fire, right? But anything beyond that is a bad fire. And so, if unless you can sort of guarantee that you're going to have less than 5% tree mortality, for example, if you do a prescribed fire, well, then heads are going to roll. I mean, that's the history of this. And we need to get beyond that. So if someone is going to do prescribed fire, which in the wildlands and the more backcountry forests, it's not appropriate because it doesn't create that heterogeneous mix of conditions. It doesn't create those nice patches, those bigger patches of snag forests that so many imperiled wildlife species depend on. But there's definitely a role for that closer to communities, closer to homes, where you don't want large patches of high-intensity fire for social reasons. And so we need to change the incentives, though. So it's someone's head doesn't roll if they get, 8% tree mortality instead of 3%. That needs to be okay. That needs to be understood, that that's part of a desired condition for heterogeneity, and it's site-specific, instead of this sort of cookie-cutter approach, managing only for homogeneous low-intensity fire. Those are the main ones, I think. But, of course, the other one is just the fact that the fire suppression program itself is big business. Is a lot of money, billions of dollars every year being spent on fire suppression. And as long as that is the case, and we don't actually look at that critically from a societal standpoint, of does that match our ecological needs, then I think that's going to continue. So right now what I see is a lot of money being wasted trying to stop weather-driven backcountry wildland fires that cannot be stopped, putting firefighters' lives unnecessarily at risk, and instead we need to rein that money, that funding in, and focus on protecting communities and stop trying to suppress those backcountry fires.
Okay, we're running out of time, so I hate to say it, but we probably only have time for one more question. Although, if everybody here is willing to stay for a little bit, you can come up and ask a few more. Okay, you've got your hand up.
From my perspective, we talk about these things as if we have a choice and if we're directing this and it's our decision to make. And I think that I'm not an expert on the legal liabilities, but I've not seen evidence that the Forest Service can be held accountable in that respect. I know they're nervous about it, but I haven't seen any actual evidence that they're held accountable. But I think that the courts need to evolve too and understand, catch up with the science, that it's not the Forest Service's job or under their control whether or not a particular fire gets stopped. they don't just decide, you know, we're going to stop that fire before it burns to that private land. That fire is going to burn if it's under high fire weather, and it's going to do what it's going to do until the weather changes. Then it will slow down when the temperature goes down, the humidity goes up, there's a little rainfall, maybe the wind dies down. That's what's going to dictate what that fire does and whether it stops spreading fast and ultimately goes out. It's not up to the Forest Service. And I think that that plays right into your question about liability, because liability is about responsibility and about what you can and can't actually do.
Okay. If there's any other short one question, I'll take it. But otherwise, maybe come on. Okay.
Just an essential point. Everybody knows embers drive a fire. Walmart is not going to stop the fire.
Right. Okay, good. All right, thank you. If you want to ask some extra questions, the panelists will be here. Thank you very much for coming. Appreciate it.
Thank you.